Looky here, looky here. It's Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com. I'm Amelia Dalton, and this week, my friends, we're taking on HBM. Yes, high bandwidth memory. We're looking at the what, why, and how of HBM with my friend Mike Gianfagna from eSilicon. What kind of designs is it best suited for, and how does it compare with the hybrid memory cube? Check it out. Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. It's always good to talk to you.
So you guys have been in the HBM game for a couple years now. For my audience who may not know, what is HBM and what kind of designs is it best suited for?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about it. First, in terms of history, HBM is a technology that allows 2.5 and 3D designs. So that's kind of the start. At the high level, it's a sophisticated way to pack lots and lots of memory into a very high bandwidth interface to a processing chip, an ASIC typically. And to do that, you need 2.5D design technology. So what's interesting is I've been watching this market, and literally since 2007, I've been convinced next year, 2.5 and 3D is about to take off. And I've been wrong every year until this year. It's finally actually happening. So it took a while, but this is an enabling technology that's helping to bring literally a whole new technology wave to the semiconductor industry. We've actually been involved in this since back around 2011 it started. We have a program called Mosaic Modular Z-Axis Integrated Circuit. It's a cute acronym. And this is a way of bringing different configurations of IP together into a 2.5 or 3D design. And we've been working on HBM test chips literally since that date. So had a lot of mileage on this. But HBM basically is high bandwidth memory interface, which is what HBM stands for. It's a JEDEC standard, so that's the good news. It's a well-defined standard. There are multiple companies involved in this. Hynix is involved, AMD, Samsung, NVIDIA, a whole bunch of companies. And it's a specification for how to take a stacked memory configuration and interface it to an ASIC with a well-defined, high-bandwidth, high I/O count interface so that you can get very, very fast, very low-power access to huge amounts of memory. And what's new about this is up until this kind of interface, you had to figure out how to put the memory on the chip to get that high-performance interface, right? And you just frankly can't put that much memory on a chip. You run out of room and you run out of power. So by putting it off the chip in a 3D, very densely stacked configuration, you can increase the capacity. And because it's a very high bandwidth interface that's very short distance and very close to the chip, you can keep it really fast and really low power. So it's massive amounts of memory with almost the same performance as you would get if it were literally on chip, but you could never put that much memory on chip. So that's kind of what HBM is all about.
So my audience may know the name hybrid memory cube. How does HBM compare with the hybrid memory cube?
Yeah, there's a lot of competing ideas out there. I guess just in terms of, just step back a little, which is interesting to kind of think about how we got here. So if you go back about 20 years, and don't worry, I'm not going to go through 20 years of history here, but you know, the initial specs for synchronous DRAM came out, they were about, 530 or so megabits per second was what you could get out of it. 20 years later, we have DDR4, which is the latest spec for on-chip direct interface, and that's running it at about 25 gigabits per second. So not bad. We got 48x roughly improvement in 20 years, lower power, high bandwidth. If you look at these new technologies, you've got HBM, which, as I mentioned, is a wider I/O kind of stack memory configuration. You also have HMC, which stands for Hybrid Memory Cube. It's a variation on the theme. It's another way of stacking memory into a vertically integrated kind of 3D package, if you will. And this one uses a serial I/O or a low number of pins, but very, very high bandwidth interface. So it's a different kind of standard. These things are taking us from that 25 gigabits per second up to, 256 gigabits per second, 400 gigabits per second. In fact, we can see our way to a terabit per second performance in a meaningful time frame here. So dramatically improved performance low power because of the short distances, but it's a different configuration. The HMC is not a JEDEC standard. It's kind of a consortium thing. Intel is involved, Micron, a few other companies, actually some notables like Microsoft, Altera, ARM are involved. So it's kind of a consortium thing. It promises to be slightly higher bandwidth than HBM, but it's a horse race, so I'm not sure who I'd bet on in that race. HBM is a little bit more mainstream. We're seeing real designs today. I think HMC is going to be coming a little bit later, but again, it's kind of a horse race. So there are two different variations on the same theme, which is ultra-high density memory off-chip, and then a very clever high bandwidth way to interface that memory to the chip itself so that you get the best of both worlds. You get lots of memory, but you don't clog up the chip with the memory, and you get it at low power and high performance access.
You guys have a couple different flavors of HBM, both ASIC and FPGA 2.5D projects. So tell me about both of those.
Yeah, so these are different technology proof of concept vehicles, if you will. The ASIC versus the FPGA is really just the host chip. You need a host chip that needs to consume the memory and do something with it, right? So we did one demonstration vehicle actually back in 2012 where we used an FPGA to be the processing chip, and then we put four HBM interfaces around that, and we had that working. In fact, there's some interesting pictures on our website next to a penny, so you can see how big these things are. They're roughly, I guess four times the size of a penny, but there's massive amounts of memory and processing power in this package. That first one was an industry first. We did this on what's called an organic interposer, so a little bit more information there. So all of these 2.5D and 3D approaches, especially 2.5D, which is basically silicon devices mounted on not circuit boards, but mounted on very fine pitched materials that would allow very tight integration, very close proximity, and very high bandwidth communication. So we did one back in 2012 with an organic interposer. Most designs today are using silicon interposers. So we tried using a different material, a material that's a little bit better behaved. It doesn't break as easily as silicon. It can be much bigger than silicon. It has some challenges as well. These are horse race items as well, like what's the best interposer material. So we did an experiment with an FPGA back in 2012 using an organic interposer, and at the time, it was 50% bigger than the largest silicon interposer that was ever built, because organic interposers you can make much bigger for some technical reasons. It worked. We proved that the interface worked and the FPGA was functional with all the memory. So that's what we did in 2012. Fast forward to 2015, we did another industry first. This we did with an ASIC. It was pretty big, 28-nanometer ASIC, 11 by 17 millimeters, running at 850 megahertz, had ARM cores in there, and we had eight HBM interfaces to this thing. So we put a lot more memory on it and interfaced that at a higher bandwidth and a higher performance rate to that ASIC and did a silicon interposer implementation. And that worked as well. What these chips are intending to prove, or these, actually more than a chip, more of a system in a package, but what they're intending to prove out is that the interposer is stable, that the interfaces between the chip and the memory are stable, and that the memory can operate correctly and deliver the performance required for the chip to run in mission mode. So these are the things we're proving with these designs. So there's been a bunch of them, but those are two very interesting data points that we talk about publicly, is the 2012 one, which was an FPGA, and the 2015 one, which with an ASIC.
In addition to the ASIC and FPGA families, you guys also have HBM IP. So tell me more about this IP.
So that's a little bit more of the story about what we are contributing to the party here. This is a team sport, right? I mean, there's a number of companies that have to be involved in this whole process. People that make the HBM stacks themselves, people like SK Hynix and Samsung, Intel, people who do the interposers like Amkor. And then there's the issues of how do you interface the actual chip to that memory. And there's kind of two critical components on that. There's an HBM controller that basically, for lack of a better description, call that the traffic cop or the piece of IP that worries about is the interface on or off, what memory access is happening, and manages all of that between the chip and the memory stack. And then there's the piece of IP that actually implements the physical interface, the thing that actually drives the wires and the connectivity and the bits between the memory access and the chip. And that's called the PHY, or physical interface IP. And we've actually built that as well. So we have our own physical interface IP that we've built, which is part of the story. We've done some designs, and we've actually partnered in some cases with a company called Northwest Logic that does the controller piece, and we do the PHY. So those two things together make a complete HBM interface that lets you take that memory stack and have it talk reliably, efficiently, and very fast to the chip itself. So those are the two pieces of the puzzle. The PHY is something we do, and controller is something that we get from our partner network. It's an enabling piece of IP that we saw was a critical need, and we had a lot of experience in high-performance I.O. design, so we applied that experience and built that piece, and we sell that as part of our offering, if you will, to build a 2.5D HBM system.
All right, Mike, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, I know you're a bit of a wine connoisseur, so have you had a wine recently that was just super amazing? Has there been a vineyard you visited lately that was just absolutely stellar?
Boy, oh boy. Yeah, there's a lot of answers to that question, Amelia. I would say that probably my most interesting experience of recent time has been not a wine, but a winemaker. The short story is we were at a UC Davis fundraising event. As you probably know, UC Davis is prestigious viticulture and enology school. Even the French are impressed with UC Davis. So we were there. They were doing a fundraising dinner. They had this auction for a visit with a winemaker and a blending party. And the guy's name was Greg LaFollette. And it was actually a fairly reasonably priced thing. And, you know, we banded with some of our friends and we bid for this thing and we won it. And we got to meet this guy. And what's interesting about him is he was a winemaker for many years, kind of invisible to the outside world. He was the original winemaker at a winery called Flowers Vineyard that is world famous for Pinot Noir. He was the original founding winemaker, but he's the guy behind the brand, so nobody knew who the heck he was from a consumer point of view. Well, literally, the day we got there to do the tasting, he had left another winery that he was consulting with and created his own brand called La Follette Vineyards. And we got involved with him and started blending wine and hearing about all the things he, you know, this is a guy who's invented winemaking equipment and pioneered new methods for farming. He's consulting on three continents to build new versions of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He's a real deal. He's kind of a rock star guy. And we got to meet him right when he started his own brand. So the wonderful thing about that is that with the day that we were there, with the day the winery started, so we are a member of his wine club, and we are serial number one. We're the very first ones. And he's become actually very popular now. He's in Sonoma in a town called Sebastopol. If anyone's ever in the neighborhood, I highly recommend you check him out. But it's been a wonderful experience getting to know the guy behind the wine and hearing a little bit about his history and his inventive genius mind and the things he's done, and also to taste some damn good wine along the way as well. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been, yes, the wine is good, but the story behind it has been the fun part for us.
Excellent. That was a great story, Mike. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me, as always.
Amelia, it was great talking to you. This is an exciting topic. Lots going to be going on here. Watch the press. Watch what's happening. Lots of people are going to be talking about 2.5D designs and what's happening in this world and what's going to be happening to make all of this very real for high-performance computing, networking, those kind of applications. So it's pretty exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to it.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, Amelia. Good talking to you. Take care.
So maybe when you're using that high bandwidth memory of yours, you'll be using an FPGA. And probably when you're designing with that FPGA, you'll need to be doing some synthesis at some point. And as we all know, especially those of us familiar with the trials and tribulations of FPGA design, that FPGAs demand a lot from your design tool environment, especially that synthesis part. And when our designs get bigger, with more third-party IP, design teams scattered all over the world, and don't even get me started with that power budget, the demands on synthesis are greater than ever. Well, my friends, if this sounds like a struggle you've gone through, I'd highly recommend you check out a recent episode of Chalk Talk entitled Simplify FPGA Synthesis, where I sit down with Joe Mallett of Synopsys and talk all about the latest generation of Synopsys Simplify FPGA design tools. And yes, synthesis can get easier. You can check out this episode of Chalk Talk by clicking the link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com, by heading on over to YouTube, keyword EE Journal, or by navigating on over to the On Demand section on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can also monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And if Google Plus is your thing, you can join our circle on Google Plus as well. We also have that YouTube channel I mentioned earlier, keyword EE Journal, chock full of all kinds of techie videos, our very own popular Chalk Talk webcast series, and our video series called On the Scene. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Hey, and by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, even if your company makes it, that's totally okay. Any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, I love that stuff, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of March 18th, 2016, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.